other evening, as I was watching some show on TV, an old actor came out, and the master of ceremony, the entire audience at that time, stood at their feet and gave this man the standing ovation out of respect to him for his many years of pleasing the public as a comedian. And then he adequately said, this is a very great thing. A thought came to me at that time, why should they pay so much attention to the things of the world? Why should they give a man of the world such a honor as this and a standing ovation? Yet, I know so many men of God who have served the Lord all their lives. I'm not advocating that we would give ministers of Christ a standing ovation. I'm not even suggesting. But I do think that we should give them an ovation. Prayer ovation. Any time when the gospel service stands up here and give to you a message from the Master, I would believe that we owe it to Him, to ourselves, and to our God, to silently bow our head in a silent word of prayer and give Him happy. So I ask for you this day to give to our speaker this day a prayerful oration as he brings to us this day a message. Brother Orrin Hanks.
This is supposed to be. I see some folks out in the crying room. I'd like for them to be able to hear. I'd like to read for my lesson in the 24th chapter of Matthew from the words of Christ in the Sermon on the Mount, beginning at the 42nd verse. And reading to the end of the chapter, the 5th through the 51st. Just a short reading. But know this, that if the good man of the house had known in what watch the thief would come, he would have watched and would not have suffered his house to be broken up. Therefore, be ye also ready, for in such an hour as ye think not, the Son of Man cometh. Who then is faithful and wise servant whom his Lord hath made ruler over his household to give them meat in due season? Blessed is that servant whom his Lord, when he cometh, shall find so doing. Verily I say unto you, that he shall make him ruler over all his goods. But, and if that evil servant shall say in his heart, my Lord delayeth his coming, and shall begin to smite his fellow servants, and to eat and drink with the drunken, the Lord of that servant shall come in a day when he looked not for him, and in an hour that he is not aware of, and shall cut him asunder, and appoint him his portion with the hypocrites. There shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. My text is from that reading. Therefore be ye also ready, for in such an hour as ye think not, the Son of Man cometh. The signs of the times are apparent. We've had many sermons on the prophecies regarding the last days, and that we are living in the last days is sufficiently clear and plain to all who understand any part of the gospel of Christ. It's called a time of tribulation, a time when there will be a testing and a trying of people. And we have been told that we should make ourselves ready. Well, the question has often been asked when we've heard sermons of that nature, well, what should we be doing? Just what is it that we should be doing? And last Sunday, we heard a sermon from Brother Larry Shaw in Collins that suggested that the Church of Christ people should segregate themselves into bands that would be capable of supporting each other, taking care of the needs that should arise in the times of crisis. And there have been other thoughts suggested, but the problem of Christian preparation is the subject of my talk this afternoon. And we read in Isaiah, the 52nd chapter in the 12th verse, these words, "For ye shall not go out with haste, nor go by flight." And that means one thing to me. That means that we should make some plans. That means that we shouldn't be caught unaware, and that we shouldn't have to run without having some sort of a plan made for our journey. The promise is, "For the Lord will go before you, and the God of Israel will be your rearward." Now certainly, I think that that calls for a reciprocal amount of action on our part, and that we make ready for the Lord to be our guard and our guardian, front and rear. And so I say there are three very important phases of this preparation, and they are mental, physical, and spiritual. Now, I've not given them to you in the order of their importance, but in the order of their accomplishment. We read in the scriptures that as a man thinketh in his heart, so is he. So first of all, before we can serve God in any capacity, large or small, we've got to make up our mind. We've got to know here that we want to do these things. James said that a double-minded man is unstable in all his ways. I don't know whether the word or the words shilly-shally mean anything to the younger generation or not. But that was something that my mother used to tell me when I was in a quandary as to whether I should do this or whether I should do that or whether I should do something else. She'd say, "Son, quit shilly-shally." We got to be determined in our mind what it is we're going to do. Now, if we don't think that we need any preparation, if we're sitting here under the thoughts in our minds that we don't need this preparation, we're all right just as we are, then I'm going to say that we're complacent Christians. You're filled with complacency. You think you're all right just as you are. Well, you're in the first stages of spiritual decay, which is the forerunner of spiritual death. And it isn't long before a complacent Christian becomes a consenting Christian or a consenting adult to all the temptations and to all the ramifications that the devil can throw up in your path to get your mind turned away from what you ought to be doing. So, mentally, we must first be convinced in our mind that we need Christ and that we need to follow His commandments and that we need to prepare ourselves for the condition that will sooner or later face this group of Christian people that are seeking to follow God. I believe that Saul of Tarsus, who became the Paul of the gospel, is our prime example of mental conversion. As Saul of Tarsus, he wasn't a shilly-shallying man. His mind was made up, but his mind was made up to go in the wrong direction. He was persecuting the saints, and he was busy doing it. But when he became mentally converted to know in his mind that what he was persecuting was Jesus Christ, the Lord, the Son of the living God, he became just as prolific a servant on the side of righteousness as he ever had been on the other side. Perhaps the world knows more to him outside of Christ for the spread of the gospel story than any other living human being, because he was so thoroughly convinced in his mind that he should serve Jesus Christ, his Lord. But when the mind is made up, we're ready for action. We're ready then to be able to do something. And so the need for education is an unquestioned need. We know immediately that we need to have more in our minds than just the rudiments of Christianity. And we need to know more concerning the affairs of men and the needs of the human being than just that we can sit down at the table and eat our dinner and sleep at night and restore the physical man. So we began to consider what type of education would be best suited for those who are preparing for that time when something is going to happen or something will happen of which we are not now a part of or enduring. Well, we need, for the good of the body, the welfare of the church, we need nurses, doctors, dentists, blacksmiths, veterinarians, weavers, tailors, shoemakers, teachers, and preachers, ministers. Now, all of these is necessary in the gamut of human life. When we run the course of human existence, we, one time or another, have a need for the services of one or more this category of people. Besides that, we need to know something about canning and preserving meats, and vegetables. We need to know something about how to preserve our food in case power goes off. You know, just a little over a year ago, if you remember, we had a shortage in canning lids. And to us, it was a dire shortage. It meant that a lot of our vegetables were not going to be able to be canned and preserved for future use. And it struck us so severely that every time my wife or I would see a can shelf with canning lids on it, we'd go buy some of them. And we've got quite a stock of them at our house now because we didn't stop to look to see what the other one had bought. We bought cans and lids and rubbers, and we have enough, I think, this year that will enable us, if our garden provides sufficient for the canning of our vegetables. But there may be a shortage that won't be eliminated in a short time. We're threatened with a shortage of energies, electrical and fossil fuels, as the petroleum industry reaches the limits of its productivity. And there's a lot of things that we need to know about. And as we consider this list, it keeps it growing. There are other things we can think of that we need to know something about. We need to know how to do this. We need to know how to do that. You know, as one of the advocates contained a sermon by Brother Jensen on this score. And it started me thinking on this line. And each one of these things that we can think of that we need to help support us in a time of necessity are vital. And we prepare those things mentally. That's our mental education. We determine in our mind that we need these things and we learn about them. Well, then the physical aspects take up another category. Sir William Oscar said that we should live neither in the past nor in the future, but let each day's work absorb all your interest, energy, and enthusiasm. And he also said that the best way to prepare for tomorrow is to do today's work superbly well. And I would argue with that. I think that's a very wise saying. It reminds me of one by Henry Van Dyke, who said, there is only one way to get ready for immortality, and that is to love this life and live it as bravely and faithfully and cheerfully as we can. And another great man said, Thomas Carlyle, said, our main business is not to see what lies dimly at a distance, but to do what lies clearly at hand. Now these men told the truth. And it's factual that we should do the job that confronts us and do it today, because today is the only day we have. But there is a need of prophecy. God has told us that he will do nothing except he reveal it to his servants, the prophets. So we need the prophecy that's in this Bible and the proper interpretation of it that tells us of these future events that foreshadow the life of man in these latter days. Because it gives us some knowledge of what to expect and also a knowledge of what we should do to prepare, how to meet those eventualities. And so I like this quote by an unknown author: a task without a vision becomes drudgery. Now, if we're just going to wash dishes day after day, day after day, day after day, without any vision of anything else except another pile of dirty dishes, it certainly is going to become a drudgery in the kitchen, isn't it? Or if we went out and hoed the garden and just one row after another and never had any vision or any thought that the reason we're cutting these weeds down is because there's going to be some beautiful tomatoes or some green beans or whatever it is that we're growing in this garden, the hoeing of those weeds and the cutting down of those weeds would become severe drudgery. A task without a vision becomes drudgery. A vision without a task is only a dream. Only a dream. But a vision with a task is success. To me, this embodies Christian living at its best. Striving to reach the goal of a life of Christ-like proportions. Trying to become mature Christians. No longer needing milk, but able to eat the meat. Developing our Christian attributes into such a way that we become giants spiritually as well as physically. Because to develop our physical bodies is right and proper. But when we combine it with godly living, it becomes a thing of beauty. And we remember the story of the Hebrew children, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and Daniel, who were being asked to eat of the king's food. And in their opinion, it was not the kind of food that was the best for their bodies. And so they asked the dietitian or whoever it was that was in charge of the food to let them have a trial. Try us for a while we eat our food. And then check us to see if we're not as physically fit as those who eat the king's food. And so they tried it. And they discovered that the Hebrew children were far superior in their physical attributes than those who had indulged at the king's table. A missionary who is in peak physical condition is an attribute to God's work. He's able to go long hours, hard journey, strenuous ways, and be able to do his work well and successfully. The missionary who neglects and disregards his physical fitness may become a liability not only to himself, but to the church that supports him. So we can see that there is a need of keeping ourselves in the finest of physical fitness. The strong, physically fit individual can become a glorious light and signal and example for young men and young women to follow. If they're living a Christian, God-like life, but that strong, physically fit individual can become a great influence for evil if through his acts there is a bringing forth of evil or the expressing of evil in his life. I've been trying for the last week to remember the name of the prize fighter who, well, he lived when I was a boy. He was a magnificent physical specimen. And he had a very great success in the ring. But he was one of the most terrible influences on young prize fighters, young men beginning to learn that profession that ever was known, because he trained on beer. And young men would see him in the bar rooms of New York carousing and living a wasteful, useless, vicious life. And they thought that that's the way to become a success as a boxer, as a prize fighter. And all it did was to ruin their lives and make alcoholics out of a great number of young men that were aspiring to be strong athletes. So while we aspire to become physically fit and physically strong, remember that there is a spiritual side to man's nature that cannot be denied. There are some things out of our control. We may lose an arm. We may lose a leg. We may have trouble breathing. We may have physical attributes over which we have had no control that make us weak and undeveloped. But there is one thing that we have to do when we find that condition facing us. We have to make do with what God gave us. Because there are things in our lives over which we do have control, which will make all the difference between a spiritual weakling as well as a physical weakling and a spiritual giant, though we be physical weaklings. Now, some of these things under our control is temper. We heard our speaker this morning confess the fact that he had to pray to get the strength to control his temper. But a great many people, good people, who think they are Christians, let their temper get out of hand, and they lose control of their temper. Speech is one thing over which we do have control. I'll never forget the sign that was in the library in Durango, Colorado, where I was a janitor. It said, "Speak gently." It was on the wall as you come in facing the librarian. "Speak gently and let thy voice be low." Speech is one of the things over which we have control. And that is the quality of speech is evidenced amongst children of all animal types. You can speak to a dog in such a way that that dog will immediately curl his tail between his legs and try to get out of your way. Because the voice carries with it the impact of the intent of the mind, the thought of the being. You can express love with speech, and you can express hate, disgust, or envy, or grief, or all the attributes of life. Our disposition is another thing that we can control. along with the ambitions that we have to do good work or to become, I would say, renowned, I think that there is nothing more dangerous than a willfully ambitious man. And history has proven time and time again that men with ambitions often become greedy, thoughtless, and pirates in their affairs with other human beings. So though it may be well to aspire to a certain goal, to become overly ambitious to the point where we put our brother beneath our feet, is dangerous, is deadly. Humility is another thing that we can express in our living. And what a challenge it is that God gives us to make out of our lives that He has given us, whether we be male or female, big, little, strong or weak, the challenge to become a full-grown, mature Christian, measuring up to the fullness of the stature of Christ. Yes, with a vision of what could be, and the will to make it come to pass, we can be what we want to be in life. And I wish that every young child, every boy or every girl in this room would write that upon their minds so they would never forget it. Because you can be whatever it is you want to be in this life. Good or bad. God has given you that power to become. Remember, a man's limitations are not the things that he wants to do and can't do. They're the things he ought to do, but don't. And spiritually, the third, and I think the most important, of these three items that we use to prepare ourselves for that time, we know not when, that we shall meet our Maker when He comes suddenly upon us. Now, we have spoken many, many times on love and on Christian fellowship and upon the great good that we each feel and receive from each other when we know that this feeling of love exists. You know, it's a wise observation that to love the world is no great chore, but to love that miserable guy next door, that's the problem. And you know, that puts love on a one-to-one basis, on a man-to-man basis, when God says, "Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself." And you go out in your life and you measure your love for your fellow man on a one-to-one basis. And you'll find, as we all do, that there are some individuals in our lives when we can say, "Well, I try to love him. I try to love the man. I can't love his deeds. I can't love the way he lives. I can't love this and that about him." But oh, how glad we are and how rejoicing it is to us when that individual is far away and out of sight and out of mind. And we don't have to have anything to do with it. But you and I, we have to live in a world where we rub elbows day after day with men and women of all natures, of all crafts, of all creeds. And Christ said, not only that thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself, he went just a little bit farther. He said, thou shalt love thy enemy. Pray for them that despitefully use you and persecute you. So if we're going to develop spiritually, we've got to expand our interpretation of love. It's got to grow a little bit more. Now, it's easy and has been easy for me for years to love those of my brethren. And I rejoice each time I see your faces again. For I know that here is the family of Christ. This is my family, my brothers, my sisters. And I feel at home. I feel pleasant in your presence. I feel like as if I'm wanted, that I'm appreciated, and that I'm needed. And that is something that every human being needs to feel. But how much difference and how much more difficult it is for me to have that feeling for those whose lives I would not want to take part of in one iota. I wouldn't want to associate in their way of living one bit. And yet, my command to me personally is, thou shalt love thy enemy. The man that you don't think too much of, you're still commanded to love him. Well, as a church, we have a vision. A place called Zion. We've read it in the books. We've heard it from the pulpit. And we visualize one day a place called Zion. The task. And a lot of us are going to have to get out because we're not prepared to live in Zion. Because Zion is the place of the pure in heart. So we have to begin to prepare today for that great eventuality that is tomorrow, of a place called Zion. Spirituality is a quality of human development. It doesn't happen overnight. It takes thought, time, and action combined. You can't think about it and just sit and think about it, like the monks of old, the hermits that had run off into a place where they were off away to themselves, out of the world, and away from the world and all of its temptations, and just think themselves into a Zionic condition. That ain't going to happen. That isn't going to do it. That won't get the job done. We've got to think about it. We've got to do something about it, and we've got to take the time out of this hurried life of ours to do what God wants to be done, to live our lives in the way that it should be lived. It's a quality of growth. And I'm afraid that as far as Christians are concerned, that if we were to be measured on a scale of 1 to 10 for maturity, that we'd all be down there on number 1 or 2 number on the scale, drinking milk, not ready for the mature meat of Christian life in any way. We have a vision like our minister in Collins, Brother Larry Shaw, of a people living together in a perfectly harmonious one for all and all for one society. The task of developing unselfishness, kindness, consideration of others, self-denial, and compassion. And those are qualities of life that don't just happen. We don't become kind by practicing unkindness. We don't become thoughtful by being thoughtless of our fellow man. We don't become generous by taking for ourselves everything that we see and everything that we want. How many times have you been to a church dinner and watch the lineup? Does the old, the weak, the helpless get first place? Generally, it's our youthful, vigorous boys and girls that are first in line, ready to eat. Now, children get hungry, and they're not as patient as the older folks. And so sometimes we forget that one of the greatest lessons that we can teach our children is to stand back and wait. Be thoughtful of someone else. Take your turn at the end of the line, not at the first. Now, I think that there are some ages of children where that is not advisable. I think that there are some children that are so small that their mothers should be in the line taking them through and getting them something to eat, because they are not old enough to realize the necessity of consideration of others. And it would be just as wicked to expect them to stand back and wait for someone else as it would be to expect a third grader to pass a college entrance examination. They haven't been taught. They haven't had the time to learn. But the developing of unselfishness, kindness, consideration for others, self-denial, compassion, those are the jobs that are the Christian's business today. Not tomorrow. Something that we should be working on constantly. We have another vision. I've heard it expressed innumerable times in many places. The vision, a church filled with quiet, reverent people, hungering and thirsting for righteousness. The task, promptness, on time, self-control, control of children. You know, it wouldn't hurt children to have a set of commandments in a church. Now, God wasn't backward about giving mankind a set of commandments when he says, "Thou shalt not." And he gave us several of thou shalt not. And if we want to be on God's side or having him considerate of us in any way, shape, or form, we have to live up to those thou shalt not. And it wouldn't hurt a child of any age to learn a few thou shalt not in church, in God's house. There was a beautiful poem read at the beginning of our services this morning, exemplifying what we should figuratively or mentally consider the beauty and the glory of God's house, for God's here. You know, a great many of us come here to church and we act like if we don't expect God to ever be here. This is God's house, but when's he going to get here? We've been here for an hour or two and we haven't seen anything of him yet. There was a young man in Collins that stated it in, to me, one of the simplest, most direct terms. He said, we can't expect the stranger within our doors to be any better in church than we are. If they come in and see us crowded in the aisles, talking loud, noisy, they're not going to have any respect for our church. Well, we have that task of self-control with a soft, quiet, gentle speech. If we speak to somebody and we greet each other, and we greet each other with love, and we're glad to greet each other, but it should be in a soft, quiet, gentle tone. One that carries only to the hearer, not that can be heard all over church. We should take our places in our seats and remain there. These things will accomplish the vision of a quiet, orderly, beautifully conducted house of the Lord. We will be here, and we, as we take our seats in that kind of an atmosphere, and in that kind of an attitude, and we won't look about saying, well, I wonder when God's going to get here. We will know that he's been here and he's waiting for us. Maybe the church is not a perfect institution, but it will never be better than it is until we take the problems upon ourselves. We have a vision of a ministry that serves the needs of the people, local and scattered, that will go and carry the message that God gave us, that great commandment, go ye into all the world. We have a vision of that kind of a ministry that serves the people near and far, who see and recognize the problems of life and have the God-given inspiration to solve them. The task. Men who will deny themselves daily, take up their cross daily, and follow Christ. That study to show themselves approved of God, rightly dividing the truth. Men that will dedicate their lives to God, who, having been called and accepting that call, will recognize their responsibility of not becoming one of God's unemployed. The world is full of God's unemployed. Men and women who know to do better, who know to live better, and say, well, I'll do that tomorrow. Maybe when I get things in order, when things turn out just right, when some of the things I've planned come to pass, then maybe I can do that. You know, I hate to say it, but there may be a time when God will say, I can't wait for you any longer. Sorry, you've been called, but you're no longer chosen. So the ministry of this church has a great responsibility. And when you measure that responsibility against the times that we're living in, we haven't got time to fool around. We haven't got time to wait. See if things will turn out just a little bit better for us some other day. We have a vision. Maybe it's not everybody's vision. Maybe this is just one of my visions. But I've heard other people express this desire. But it is a vision of a permanent spot in a quiet, not too remote area where we can hold our Missouri reunions year after year, the same place, with not only the possibility of holding our Missouri reunions there, but maybe of a youth camp, where our boys and girls from all over the United States can gather together and under the right kind of supervision, enjoy physical outdoor fun and the joy of being together. And you know, it might be that if we had some place like that, that our children, our boys and girls, would find their mates within the church, within the circle of the fellowship of Christ. And they wouldn't be forced, and I say literally forced, to the necessity of finding their companions in life out of the best that the world has to offer. God grant that those who are seeking their mates find the best. That the world has to offer until we can supply through our own association that association that will bring them together and give them the opportunity to choose from among the ranks of God's children, of His church children. I think there is nothing more beautiful than those who are joined in life, that are joined together spiritually in their church as well, who have the same aspiration, the same desires for worship as the other. What's the task? That's a vision. What's the task? To unify our ideas. to come together on a decision as to what we would do. What do we do? What do? Is this a vision, or is it just something that we want to talk about or think about once in a while? But if it is going to be coupled with a task, then we have to unify our ideas. We've got to get together and agree on what this vision entails. And then we have to unite our efforts and concentrate our strength and get it pointed in one direction. I can remember back, well, it's before my time here in Missouri, when there was a necessity for procuring a tent so that we could have some place to have a Missouri reunion. Well, the tent has been long outgrown, and it has long since failed to measure up to the need that we have for a Missouri reunion. But it was accomplished. It was a vision, and there was something done about it, and the tent was acquired, and it was used. But I think if we can remember a very, very many great inspirational moments that have brought good and joy to the hearts of each of us. Well, it's good for us to dream and for us to aspire. It's good for us to look forward to a time when there will be a Zion. There will be a place where each man will consider himself no better than his brother. He'll consider his brother as well as himself. What happened in the 400 years in the Book of Mormon time when they had the all things common amongst them, and each man esteemed his brother as himself? There was love, and there was consideration, there was compassion, there was generosity, kindness, unselfishness, all of these attributes all put together to work at one time. But if we only have dreams, if we only aspire, they'll never become reality. It'll never be something real. We say, we have done this, we have accomplished this. And we will still be coming to church, and we will still be listening to our minister saying, we have to prepare, we have to prepare. And you will still be sitting there, well, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? Reality is what we're going to be judged on. The things that we have done is going to be the thing that God will judge us by. Not our hopes, our aspirations, not the things that we say, well, we're going to do that someday. That's a plan we have for the future. Someday we'll do that. No, there's a very hot city whose streets are paved with good intentions that went for the board. They never got done. Now, we have a bank down in Springfield that uses for an advertisement this slogan, "Build your future today." That's what we should be doing. Building our future. Mentally, physically, and spiritually. Today. Here's a prayer. O God, Give me the sensitivity to understand, to recognize need, to appreciate, to marvel, to believe in miracles. Help me to know that only today may be mine, so that I might fill it with kindness, with sympathy, and with the rich warmth of friendliness. Keep me from fault-finding, pettiness, self-centeredness, and the tragedy of narrow-mindedness. Help me to say, here is a problem, Lord. What is my share of its solution? Help me not to forget my own strength is insufficient, but in thy love there is fortitude that is everlasting. Let us adopt for our slogan the Boy Scouts motto, be prepared. For as Christ said, therefore be ye also ready. For in such an hour as ye think not, the Son of Man cometh.
Thank you, Lord. Those words calling us to remember indeed our responsibility.